I'm Alex Kreiner. I'm a former hedge fund manager, financial and geopolitical analyst, and author of three banned books. And one of them was on the subject of Bill Browder, the Magnitsky Act, and anti-Russian sanctions published in 2017 and banned almost as soon as published. So the significance of Magnitsky. So not a household name, but Sergei Magnitsky was a dirty accountant in the service of hedge fund manager Bill Browder, who in the 1990s used to run the largest foreign-owned hedge fund in Russia. And Magnitsky helped Browder devise schemes and structures to minimize his tax bill in Russia, some of which turned out to be illegal. Doing things illegally was not a problem in the 1990s under Boris Yeltsin in Russia, but it did become a problem in the 2000s under Vladimir Putin. And so there was a conflict, obviously, between Western financial interests and Russia. Bill Browder had to flee. That is, he was thrown out of Russia. His visa was canceled in 2005, and then he became the world's most prolific peddler of Russophobia and anti-Russian campaigns. Part of that entailed lobbying through the US Congress a piece of legislation called the Magnitsky Act, which finally passed in December of 2012. And it was widely considered to be the opening salvo in the new Cold War between Russia and the United States. Bill Browder continued to agitate and got the Magnitsky legislation passed in. I think a total of about 30 Western legislations. The Magnitsky Acts are ostensibly human rights laws, but in reality, they are legal barriers between Western jurisdictions and Russia, and then anywhere else in the world subsequently, by which, let's say, Russia or other countries could challenge Western financiers for what had happened in the 1990s. What had happened in the 1990s during the transition from communism to capitalism in Russia, in which Bill Browder participated, was simply a pirate raid, industrial scale looting and plunder of Russian wealth to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars. And by that, I'm talking about book value of enterprises, not just market cap. So an absolutely massive pirate raid on Russia. And as it happens, when it comes to tracing money and financial assets, you can trace their trail all the way to the beneficial owners, to the ultimate, crooks and thieves. And in order to prevent Russian investigators to do that, to bring their court cases to Western jurisdictions like New York and Washington and Cyprus and Zurich and so forth, this is why the Magnitsky Act was passed in all these 30 Western jurisdictions. So that's the significance of Magnitsky Act. It enabled a cover-up and a whitewash of the probably the largest ever conceived and executed pirate raid by Western financial interests against Russia.
Well, yes, there were other pirate raids. We had a few. For example, we had the Europeans don't seem to like Russia for some reason. The attack by Napoleon, On Russia. We also then, of course, had First World War time, the Bolshevik Revolution, which Churchill described as a plague bacillus being injected into Russia from Switzerland in the form of the Bolsheviks. And then, of course, we had Adolf Hitler. Do you think in the 1990s this was just another kind of latest succession of assaults by European oligarchs into old Mother Russia in sort of Asia, well, which straddles Europe and Asia?
Yes, absolutely. And the raids that you mentioned, there were military raids, but there were also raids that were conducted as color revolutions, which was basically what the communist revolution in 1917 was. It was a color revolution by the Bolsheviks against the Tsarist regime. But again, it was controlled and directed and orchestrated and financed by Western financial interests. And then, Russia has been at the receiving end of Western attacks, invasions, sabotage and terrorism pretty much since the 16th century with the Polish-Lithuanian invasion. Then there was the Swedish invasion, always financed by Western bankers, incidentally.
Why?
As Why? Well, it's in the nature of this governance system, which is a money lending oligarchy, which has to continue to conquer colonies in order to turn them into their own collateral. So you always go after all the resource rich areas of the world. You take control of those of their natural wealth. You turn that natural wealth into collateral for your own banking establishments, and you turn the populations of those areas into slave labor force, or if not slave, then into serfs or really, really cheap labor force. For example, at the end of the 1990s, when Vladimir Putin came to power, the average salary in Russia was $56 a month. That's always part of that same equation that defines the colonialist system of governance. And so that's why it's done that way. And then, the way our monetary system functions, the way the banking system works, if you can secure any source of wealth and turn it into your own collateral, that source of wealth becomes your source of wealth. And if you're a banker, you didn't have to fight any wars, you didn't have to develop anything, you just simply with a stroke of a pen, turned it into your wealth. How does that work? Let's say that you take political control of some oil-rich nation like Nigeria or Saudi Arabia, let's say. Now, they have a lot of oil, and in order for that oil to flow to the world markets, it has to be developed, which means that you have to make a large investment to develop that resource, to drill it out of the ground, to build tanker farms, distribution systems, to build tankers, to build refineries, and so forth. So it's a massive investment, which of course maybe the local economy can do in Nigeria and or Saudi Arabia. But if you impose that it has to be your banks that will finance that development, and that those loans will be secured by the resource underground, by the that co as collateral, then by a stroke of a pen, that natural wealth anywhere in the world becomes yours, okay? Because then, based on that collateral, you can issue loans to your clients, meaning your, the multinational corporations that will go and develop the resource, like BP or Royal Dutch Shell or ExxonMobil or whatever. And so, once you've issued those loans become assets on your balance sheet. And they're performing assets because now your clients have to repay them with interest. So suddenly, you've created these loans out of thin air, thanks to the fact that there's money, good collateral backing them. And you've given those loans to your clients, and now your clients have to pay those interests, those loans back with interest. So basically, it's paper agreements, all of it, and it's money created out of thin air. But now suddenly, based on those assets, based on Nigerian oil reserves or Saudi oil reserves or Russian natural gas or palladium deposits or South Africa's gold deposits, all of that becomes your wealth. Whereas other people waged wars, other people died and fought for this, other people worked to extract those resources and bring them to the global markets, and all you did is issue loans. So it means you didn't dirty your hands in the slightest, but the bulk of the wealth that there is in the world will now be flowing to your financial institutions.
Yeah, but there are many countries around the world doing this. Surely the Russian oligarchy, including Putin, can see the benefits of doing this for themselves, so they should join the club.
Well, yeah, I think that's the misconception that exists in the West, because many people, even when they become aware of how the system works, they assume that everybody else would conduct their business in exactly the same way. So what's the difference? London bankers, New York bankers, Moscow bankers, Beijing bankers, it's all the same, right? Well, as it happens, it's not all the same. This Europe-centric colonialist period, which we can trace back 500 or 600 years, has been, I think, one of the most pathogenic systems of governance ever to emerge in the world. The Russians have never done this in their history. The Chinese have never done this in their history. They never colonized. They never developed slave trade. It's something peculiarly Western, and it's formed a cultural dimension. And so in these 500 years, Western powers, always driven forth by the banking interest, have wiped out six major indigenous civilizations around the world, and thousands of smaller cultures and kingdoms and tribes, and we've depopulated huge swathes of the earth. There used to be a native population in the Caribbean Isles. It's gone now completely. There used to be a native population in Tasmania. It's 100% depopulated and genocided. We've genocided something like 80 or 90% of, no, sorry, greater than 90% of Aboriginal population of Australia, of North America's, Mayas, Incas, Aztecas, African tribes and culture. This is not the same. You cannot say that the Russians have done the same, or that the Chinese have done the same, or that the Indians have done the same. This is very much a Western European system of governance, which is different, because even if you own and control banking establishments, colonizing abroad is a choice. You don't have to make that choice. You can make a good living. You can generate a lot of wealth without destroying the whole rest of the world. This is something truly demonic and satanic, which emanated from the City of London and to a large extent from Paris as well over the last several centuries. And if we trace its origin, we can go back to the Bank of Amsterdam, and then from there back to Venice, Venetian Empire, which was also the empire of the money lending oligarchs. And then from there, the picture gets a bit pixelated, but it seems to lead back to Rome. And then if you study history, you realize that the very same system of governance drove the Roman Empire to its destruction, and it existed also in Greek antiquity.
Well, I mean, this is an interesting lineage. I'd add to that the Phoenicians and Carthaginians. The significance for this today is crucial, really, because of the amazing sight to see all these European leaders, including the unelected Ursula von der Leyen, heading over to the White House after Trump's meeting with Putin and then Zelensky. So can you just, there are two kind of major points of negotiation here, plus anything else you'd like to throw in you think was going on behind the scenes. One is the presence of NATO troops as a so-called reassurance force in Ukraine after some kind of deal. And the other, of course, is the Donbass and whether or not the Russians are going to secure that.
I don't think there's really any question about any of that. The Russians have been waging war in Ukraine for 2.5 years now. Sorry, 3.5 years now. And they sustained more than 100,000 casualties at a great economic cost as well. 1.7 million Ukrainians were killed in that process. And the reason for this is that the Russians were absolutely adamant that Ukraine has to stay neutral and that it has to never, ever enter into NATO. They were very clear about this. So now any talk of NATO troops entering Ukraine as reassurance forces, which is fa a fantasy that, Emmanuel Macron has been floating, for I think more than a year now, I think it's just empty talk. It's not going to happen. It may go around in the newspapers. It may be discussed by the pundits. It may be discussed by people like Starmer and Macron. But I think that that's generally wishful thinking, and it's not going to happen.
Okay, so what about the territory, the Donbass, Zaporizhia, Kherson, Lugansk, and Donetsk?
I'm not sure what's going to happen. What I know is that the Russians are not obsessed with territory. And, the reason why they're not obsessed with the territory, they were determined to retain the use of Sevastopol and Crimea because they need exit to warm seaports. And in 2014, NATO was about to evict them from there. So they took Crimea. But apart from that, what the Russians need is a government in Kiev that is going to realign with Moscow. And they want Ukraine to become something like Belarus is today, a friendly nation, an ally, and basically a buffer between Russia and the Western powers. The problem that the Russians have is that they don't have natural defenses. Great Britain is an island, so it's surrounded by the ocean. The United States is also insulated by two oceans, the Pacific and the Atlantic. There's nothing between Western powers and Moscow, but flat steppeland that can be traversed by any invasion force. So the Russians are very, very sensitive to the question of security. And for that reason, Belarus and Ukraine are very important to Russia as at the very least neutral buffer states, but preferably friendly and allied buffer states. So that's what the Russians want. They don't need the territory. They don't, they don't obsess over maps and what color which territory is colored in. That's largely a Western construct. They want the government in Kiev to be neutral, to be friendly with Moscow, and to be cooperative. And this is what they're driving at. So, where exactly the demarcation lines are going to be, who's going to control what territory, that's very secondary to the Russians.
Well, that's fair enough. You can understand that. But what do you make of the extraordinary first-class plane flights over to United States of all these European leaders after the appearance of Zelensky and their relationship to Donald Trump? Because he does seem to be somebody who's slightly above or below the deep state in the United States, not quite singing from the same hymn sheet as the Bilderbergers, for example.
Yeah, that's extremely interesting. I think that the European powers, and in this sense, I'm speaking in particular about London. The European powers have made themselves so very dependent on the United States, not just in terms of military power, but also in terms of economic power, that they are now at a loss as to how to proceed. They're not capable of putting together a credible military force to confront Russia, which is what they want to do. And so they're completely dependent on the United States. And so when Donald Trump started talking peace with Vladimir Putin, all these presidents and prime ministers of leading European powers were able to suddenly clear their schedules and fly over to Washington to sit like a bunch of errant school children in front of the principal, to try to beg them to try to beg him to come back on board, to love them, to protect them, and to lead them. And so that's the spectacle we just saw, and I think that what it signifies is probably the end of the European Union and the end of NATO. And let's not forget, Tony, there's also a question of about $300 billion worth of Russian frozen assets, the bulk of which is in Europe. So I think about $190 billion or so is stuck in Belgium at the Euroclear institution. $70 billion was supposed to be in France, but apparently it's much less now, which is unclear why, but it could be that Macron and his government already helped themselves to a lot of that money. About $37 billion is supposed to be in London. And I think that one thing that is predictable about Donald Trump is that he will want that money in the United States. So if he talks to Vladimir Putin, one of the likely deals that they're going to make is for Russia to invest its frozen assets in the United States. Trump needs that, and he can have it. And we've already seen him, go around the Middle East and elsewhere and shake down all these leaders for large-scale investments, including Ursula von der Leyen, right? to make large-scale investments in the United States. We're talking hundreds of billions of dollars. And so I think that it's a question of days or weeks, maybe, when we will find out that Trump and Vladimir Putin agreed that Russian frozen assets would be invested in the United States. The Russians are going to give an order, and the Eurotards are going to have to comply. They will have no other choice because Trump is going to say, send the money over to us or else. What could or else be? It's not that Trump is going to start bombing European capitals, but European financial system is very highly dependent on the American financial system. You see, the bulk of global trade is conducted in dollars. And European banks already for many months have had very severe problems with US dollar liquidity. So they don't have enough dollars. And they need dollars, you know, to buy oil and gas and other stuff. And so thus far, they've been bailed out by the New York Fed, which has extended almost limitless swap lines for European banks to be able to conduct global trade in US dollars. All that Trump has to do to plunge Europe into a severe financial crisis and the breakdown of trade and payment systems in dollars is to simply cut those swap lines, and the consequences would be disastrous. So the Europeans are going to have to comply, which means that those $300 billion, of which about 280 or 290 are in Europe, are going to change hands. They're going to go back to the United States. European leaders were already counting on that money to be their own collateral, you know, to fuel a large-scale credit cycle for rearmament and infrastructure investments in Europe. And now it seems that the bottom's going to fall out of all those dreams. This is, you know, I think this is the reason why you see such alarm in those faces sitting across the desk from Donald Trump. They are absolutely lost and panicked, and they do not have a plan B. And why do they not have a plan B? Because for decades, they've been very confident that they can manipulate the United States to their advantage indefinitely. But that's, you know, that's because they don't know their history. And they should know that every so often, every few decades, maybe once in a generation, the United States brings some kind of a resistance to this system, some kind of a reaction. And so, you know, in our time, that reaction is Donald Trump. But, you know, Donald Trump is not the first one who's tried to steer the course of the United States away from attachment to European powers.
Now, well, is it also possible that with meeting with Putin, I quite like the way Trump has done this over the years, meeting directly with foreign leaders. It may be that the US intelligence services and the Europeans are not telling him quite a lot of things. They're keeping stuff from him, and that maybe they're nervous that Putin is telling him things that they have been withholding from Trump.
Yes, I think you're right about that. And I think that this is maybe the reason why Trump has relied so much on Steve Witkoff, you know, because he is his man of confidence. He's a personal friend. And so, you know, when it came to discussing delicate matters, Trump was sending Witkoff around the world, you know, who is not, he's not a product of the deep state of the United States. He's not controlled by the CIA, or at least I presume that he's not. And so he was able to talk and communicate with the Russians in the way that Trump wanted, rather than, you know, in his last administration, he had there John Bolton and Mike Pompeo and Mad Dog Mattis and all these people like that who are absolutely part of the swamp and who sabotaged a lot of Trump's initiative. And, as we remember, he was really not able to do much about U.S. relations
Well,
with Russia.
pretty much nothing. Anyway, look, you and I cannot chat without mentioning what's going on in Gaza and Israel, the other big conflict in the news. And I wonder what you make of the move into Gaza City by Netanyahu. I mean, this seems unbelievable, really. The place is already an absolute hellhole. That we just had one of the last journalistic teams from Al Jazeera last weekend completely wiped out in a missile strike, a bomb strike of some sort. What is there any kind of Netanyahu's in this situation where if he ends this war, his coalition will probably collapse with the far right, and then. You have an election, and then possibly Netanyahu will go to jail. So, do you see any way out of this kind of political? It's all, it seems to me now, all about Netanyahu's political survival, and he's prepared to lie absolutely through his teeth and say absolutely anything in order to keep the war going, it seems, which is not really a war, of course. It's a mass slaughter, it's a genocide along the lines of the sort of thing the British used to do to the Native Americans.
Yes, and I think that this is not going so well. And there are many reports about Israeli troops getting slaughtered in Gaza, and apparently the Israelis are hiding much, much higher casualties than they acknowledge officially.
Yeah,
I
just
hear
like
that.
Ukraine. But look, Alex, what about, is there any sort of solution to this, do you think? I mean, can the UN do anything? A peacekeeping force, just getting aid in? Is there anything that can sort this out at all?
I think the solution is an end of Israel. I think that's the solution. And to give himself another lease of life, it seems that Netanyahu and his government are planning another attack on Iran, and the Iranians are absolutely convinced that that attack is coming and that it might be coming, within this month, which means what are we, 21 August? So, within the next 10 days, this might happen. And there are now voices growing louder in Iran that Iran shouldn't sit there and passively wait for Israel to attack, that they should attack Israel preemptively, and that that attack should be such that Israel will never again be able to respond. They have prepared for this, and apparently they have enough drones and missiles lined up that they can, what they've done for 12 days this year, earlier this year, they will be able to do for 2 years around the clock. So that might diffuse the situation, but I don't know what the solution is, Tony. This is like something I never thought I would see in my lifetime. But there we are.
Yeah, pretty horrific. Anyway, also, you mentioned the leak, or I say the leak, it's in all around the world, but it's not in the Western press. This is about the 1.7 million casualties that the Ukrainians have taken. The Russian have got into the database of the Ukrainian army. This is completely kept from that. I mean, this is a kill ratio of something like 17 to 1, nearly 20 to 1. Ukrainians dying per Russian, and also, of course, the front is currently collapsing. So, with your analysis, I'm just a little bit frustrated that we're not seeing a bit more of you, Alex, on the Western press. When were you last on the BBC?
I can't remember, Tony, but BBC does invite me once every 60 years or so, it should be any day.
Because this is a big part of it, isn't it? The way the press present all this to the public now seems to be almost, straight out of the playbook of Joseph Goebbels.
Well, unfortunately, people in the West grew up thinking that the press is there to inform them, which is only partly the truth. When it comes to important matters, The press is there to peddle a propaganda. I grew up in the East in the communist world, and I always knew that the press was propaganda. But people in the West, I think, maybe only in the last 5 years, given the event of 2020, are starting to realize that the media really are the enemies of the people, as Trump has called them. And their whole job is to make sure you don't understand what's really going on, and to give you a false narrative, and to mislead you, to act against your own interest, maybe to send your children to war to fight and die against, what Macron called the ogre at our gates, which he was referring to the Russians, to scare you. So that you would say, okay, well, I'll sacrifice my children just to make sure that this ogre doesn't beat down my doors and invades my home. So that's the role of the media. And they have done that forever. They've done that forever. It's not a new thing. It's just that people in the West, they haven't lived these days of, pandemics and wars. So they kind of thought, like, oh, BBC, the wonderful people who informed us in a fair and balanced way about what's going on so that we would be in the know. That's all a big lie.
Well, yeah, but this is not a winning strategy. It's a losing strategy. Do they care?
Well, no, they don't care, because they thrive on chaos. They don't, you know what they say, the wars are not meant to be won, they're meant to be fought permanently. Because they, okay, so if you have the monopoly on financial capital, on advanced technologies, and particularly on military technologies, then you thrive on war. You want wars to go on forever. Why? Because while there's a war, let's say if you pit two countries into war, like, I don't know, Armenia and Azerbaijan. First thing they're going to need when they're at war is they're going to need credit. They're going to need money.
You're going to have to wind up in 30 seconds, Alex, so make it quick,
Okay.
please.
They're going to need money. They're going to need technologies. They're going to need military hardware. And if you have the monopoly on all of those things, they're going to be dependent on you, and you're going to be able to support each side and make them your own debtors. And that's how the system works.
Website?
Two Substacks, Alex Craner's Substack, and iSystem Trend Following, which is daily newsletters for traders and investors.
Alex Craner, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Tony. Thank you for having me.